This lecture series occurs every Saturday in April and May at the library. It's been funded by the LDF Foundation of San Rafael, California, here by San Francisco. It's a small grant, but small enough and large enough to be able to hold this lecture series. This grant came through to the Old Spanish Trail Association. The Old Spanish Trail is located in about 7 different states, but they're all within the same region of the Southwest. Here in Taos, we have about, 3 or 4 members, but now individuals have been joining. So we have about maybe 24 members. And the membership fee is low, it's $25 to join each year. On this table, we have some membership forms that describe the association and the rates for members. It's 25 individual, it's 30 family. And this lecture series is occurring to provide information to you all on research that individuals have done on their own. I call them grassroots research specialists because they're from the comunidad. They're from the community. They do research. And some of the presentations are done by PhDs like Ronaldo Cantu. Recently we had Dr. Jose Rivera. He spoke about Osequia culture, about Osequia and the Sociedad, the Society of Workers, an organization that was started in the Taos area and included members from Southern Colorado. Anyway, so let me just welcome everyone, including the ones that are standing outside the door. Thank you to the library for providing this space to hold these lectures in April and May, every Saturday. The lecture series are free, you don't charge, like some other organizations in Taos charge $10 to go to the lecture. Well, these ones are free. Thanks to the LEF Foundation of San Rafael, California, San Francisco. The theme focus of these lectures is Native American origins of this trail and trade. Trade not only in physical material merchandise, but also trade in ideas and trade in captives. I would like to present to you Paul H. Martinez, today's presenter, and I better stop.
Good morning. Today I will be talking to you about a massacre that occurred in what is now Ranchos de Taos in August of 1760. But first I would like to give you a timeline of other events that happened between 1598 and 1760. The year 1598, Juan de Oñate, along with 129 soldiers and their families, settle in what is now the pueblo of Oque Owingue and christen it San Juan de los Caballeros. In 1680, the Pueblo Indians are tired of Spanish rule and they drive the Spaniards all the way back into what is now El Paso del Norte, killing several hundred men, women, children, and priests. In 1692, Capitán General y Gobernador Don Diego de Vargas, Luján, Zapata, Ponce de León y Contreras reestablishes Spanish rule in New Mexico. In 1710, Cristóbal de la Serna applies and is granted a land grant in what is now Rancho de Taos, New Mexico. It encompasses 35 square miles. De la Serna never establishes residency. And while on a punitive mission against the Pawnees, he is killed. His children sell the land grant to a man by the name of Diego Romero. Diego Romero considers himself a coyote, or genizaro, or mestizo, part Indian and part Spaniard. Diego Romero has a sister, her name is Ana Maria. They are the children of Alonso Cadimo and Juana de Tapia, who are servants in the Hacienda Feliberto Romero and take his name for their own. In In 1710, Ana Maria marries a soldier by the name of Juan de Villa El Pando, who arrived in Santa Fe in 1693. The name Villa El Pando is later changed to the name Villalpando. Juan Villalpando and Ana Maria have four children together, one of them being my ancestor, Pablo Francisco Villalpando. In 1760, Pablo Francisco is the owner of the biggest hacienda on the La Serna land grant. There are 12 other families living alongside. In June of 1760, Bishop Pedro Tamaron arrives from Mexico to inspect the settlements in northern New Mexico. He describes Pablo Francisco as being very wealthy and highly civilized. This is my ancestor. 250 years later, I don't consider myself neither of them. He also describes the house of a wealthy Indian and very well-to-do, meaning the house of Pablo Francisco. It is well-fortified, it has four towers, and has arms for defense. By describing Pablo Francisco as highly civilized, the bishop probably meant that he was literate. On August 4th, 1760, as many as 3,000 Comanches descend on the Taos Valley. Their intent is to destroy the Taos Pueblo. However, for some reason or other, they might have found it too well fortified. They turn their attention on the 12 families living in ranchos. There are 14 male members, along with a large number of women and children, and they fortify themselves inside the hacienda. The battle rages on for a whole day, and finally the overwhelming force of the Comanches breach the walls, and they kill all the male defenders. Francisca Luján, who is Pablo Francisco's wife, fights till the end, fighting the invaders with the lance. At this time, everybody's killed, all the male defenders, and 56 women and children were taken captive by the victorious Comanches. At this point, three generations of my ancestors survived the massacre, one being Pablo Francisco, one being his daughter, Maria Rosa Villalpando, or Villalpando, and her son, Jose Julian Jaquez, who is 2 years old at the time. Maria Rosa is married to Juan Julian Jaquez, and they have a two-year-old son, Jose Julian Jaquez. Juan Julian Jaquez is killed in the massacre. The whereabouts of the child is not known at this point. Pablo Francisco is away on business, supposedly on a horse buying trip. Maria Rosa is taken captive along with the other ones. Some of the captives are later recaptured, ransomed, or redeemed. Maria Rosa is not. She will never see Taos again. In 1764, a Frenchman, check my French here, guy, by the name of Jean Salé de la Joie, arrives in St. Louis. He is one of the original 30 settlers that settled St. Louis. Between 1765 and 1770, he lives among the Pawnees. At this point, the Pawnees have bought or bartered Maria Rosa from the Comanches, and she's living among them. He lives among the Pawnees for several years, and he takes Maria Rosa with him to St. Louis, to Missouri. At this point in her history, Maria Rosa, the Spanish Maria Rosa, is now the French Marie Rose, and instead of Villalpando, her name is Villalpain. Maria Rosa and Jean Salé have four children together. After 20 years of marriage, Salé moves back to his native France and wills his estate to Maria Rosa. In 1802, Jose Julian Jaquez, who was 2 years old at the time of the massacre, is 44 years of age and finds that his mother is alive and living in St. Louis. He makes the long journey and is reunited with her. They have a happy reunion. Jose Julian at this point has 11 children, the youngest being 1 year old. He stays in Missouri for 10 years. And upon his departure, he is given an inheritance by his mother of 200 pesos. And Maria Rosa is a mystery to this day. Historians have put her birth date in the year 1723, some in 1739. And had she been born in 1739, she would have been 21 years older than Saleh. And there is also a story that the Indians came to exterminate the Pueblo Indians because she had been promised to one of the Comanches chieftains, I guess, and they didn't fulfill their promise. But that is another story that is in another place in Tomé. So that, and anyway, Maria Rosa passes away in the year 1830. She lives to be between 90 and 100 years old. And in Josiah Gregg's book, he writes that she lamented her woes throughout her life. This woman went through a lot of tragedy, trauma and tragedy. She was bought, bartered, and sold. She had children from three different men, a Spaniard, a Pawnee, and a Frenchman. And I am proud to be one of her descendants. I often ask my mom. My mom passed away in 2005 at the age of 79. I would say, Mom, do you recall one of your ancestors as being taken into captivity? And she would tell me that her mom would sing a song. And the song went, Cuando pasé el río Puerco, ahí tiré mi tumbaguita, para que se acuerden mis padres que aquí va su cautivita. When I crossed the Rio Puerco, there I threw my shawl, so my parents will know that here goes their captive daughter. At this time, I would like to read a poem that is one of my favorite poems. This poem was composed by my friend Alberto Vidaure, who is a historian and a genealogist, and it goes like this. It's about our ancestors or our abuelos, grandparents. Ay, abuelitos, este mismo sol, the same sun that shines on me today, you welcomed for its light and warmth, and yes, perhaps sometimes cursed as it burns so hot on you, my ancestors. Luna tan clara y tan brillante, and the stars that tonight light our night skies, one shine upon and guided you. Our ancestors, as you walked and sometimes rode your noisy carretas that carried all of your worldly goods, your shovels, your hammers, axes, hoes, and plows, as you led, dragged, pushed, and pulled your oxen, your burros, horses, goats, sheep, and cows. Ay, abuelitos, how your hearts must have suffered to see and hear a tus hijitos, the children that with dry, trembling, cracked lips asked you for water. How did you comfort them? And throughout the long hot days and at night when they cried, agua, mama, agua, tengo sed. Ay, abuelitos, tell me, please, I need to know, was it gold? Oro that brought you here, as some now say. Was it gold that made you endure the heat, the thirst, the hunger, the sickness, the wounds and the pain, the cold and pains of your death, and the death of your loved ones? Was it gold, as some now say, that stilled the longings in your soul, the pains of emptiness, the terrible pains of loneliness in your hearts, for your homes and for your loved ones, your fathers and your mothers, your little sisters and your brothers, the ones you left behind with tears in their eyes and pain in their hearts? Ay, qué dolor, not knowing if you would ever see them again. Was it gold or was it hope? The hope, the dream, el deseo, el sueño of most parents, to make it better for your child, that your children may have a little better than you did. Ay, abuelitos, de rodillas su bendición les pido, y por hacer y sufrir y aguantar, todo por sus hijos, las gracias les quiero dar. Gracias de mi corazón, mil gracias. Abuelitos, for deep within me, I carry a little bit of you, and my children's children will carry it too. Gracias, mil gracias. Questions?
Okay, questions, answers, preguntas y respuestas.
Yes. It's completely wiped out, yeah. But it was, when it's where ranchos exist today, that's where the hacienda once stood, yeah. Si, senor?
I was looking at some aerial photographs that were taken by the Bureau of Land Management in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
I think 59. And I saw the footprint of the hacienda, and it was in the form of a fortified star, typical of forts of that period. And it's actually located in the flats right below the chapel in Talpa. And I looked at that footprint, and I am certain it's the Villalpando Hacienda.
Very good.
When did the people start coming back into Rancho?
I would say that probably there's no evidence that the place was torched or the people were taken, and I'm sure that the ones that survived probably made their way back soon afterwards.
Because of the Vigil Torreon, I'm in the Vigilis clan up there on the Rancho's Ridge. I'm almost certain that they came back almost immediately.
Yeah. A lot of these, the Apaches, the Comanches would loot and pillage, but it was a way of life with them, because by not exterminating all the people or torching the place, they would leave them enough livestock where they could come back a year later and do the same thing over again. Yeah, that was not uncommon. Mm-hmm. I think in this case, the Villalpando Hacienda was so well fortified that to breach it, they had to do a lot of killing. Yeah, so. And then children and women back at this time were just commodities, you know, to be sold and traded, you know. On my mom's side, my great-grandmother was just the opposite. She was taken captive by the Spaniards. She was full-blooded Apache. So that's where my Apache blood comes in. On the Martinez side, they took another one in 1867 by the name of Manuel de Atocha. They took him in Mora, that's Arsenio Cordova's great ancestor, and never to return again. But my ancestor Maria Rosa lived to tell her tale. That's why I'm here today, and she is the progenitor of the Valdez and Jaques families. I live in Valdez. And guess why it's named Valdez?
So, ranches. I was just wondering. It's such an old place, and the energy there and everything. So there has been a lot of massacres, a lot of fights and everything in there.
Well, this one was so big that I don't think we need another one. But that's the one that I know of. There might have been more. And, of course, you know, there's been other massacres here in Taos, though. When they scalped Governor Bent, and they made their way to the Turley place in Valdez, in Cañoncito, and several... Simeon Turley was massacred, and several Frenchmen. Yeah.
Where do we look for lineage in ranchos? My grandparents have already passed away. I've written things down, but...
Well, you need to find out who your grandparents were and your great-grandparents, and then you need to talk to this man over here, Alberto Vidaure. He's probably the best genealogist here in Taos, yeah. He got me started in this... about 10 years ago, and I've never forgiven him for it.
Well, did you mention the Genisaro aspect of your culture?
Of my family?
Yeah.
Well, I have, I think in every side of my family, I have Genisaros. On my mom's side, as I just mentioned, my great-grandmother was full-blooded Apache. And then, of course, Ana Maria, who is the mother of Pablo Francisco, was considered himself a coyote or half Indian. So, yeah. Yeah, they say that when the first Spaniards came to New Mexico, that they were already mixed with Indians. That's right.
You know, if you've ever done DNA or anybody's done DNA of the Hispanics here, what they do is they will typically pick up Eurasian on your mother's side. And of course, that tells you right there that the minute that the Spaniards came into Mexico, you know, they were already mixing.
Yeah.
So by the time they got here, they had mixed with Mexico. You know? Yeah. So we've been mixed and remixed many times.
Well, I tell these people that tell me that they insist that they're Spaniards, I tell them, if you're not a Genizaro, then you must be part burro, because that's all the Spaniards brought with them when they came to the New World.
Yeah, one guy said one time, anybody that says they're pure Spanish here must have gotten on the boat in Spain and got off the boat in New Mexico.
Yeah.
That's all that's going to work.
I wanted to add, concerning that about Genizaro, there's a really excellent, great, dynamic, I don't know what other adverb to use, just kidding, adjective. There's a really fantastic book here called Comanche Empire by Pekka Hämäläinen. I said it wrong, but Hämäläinen. It's called the Comanche Empire, and it is excellent about the Comanches. And there's a section in there that talks about the Genizaros. Genizaros were Pueblo Indians, like from Abiquiú. They were Pueblo Indians, but they became allies with the Spanish. And the Spanish said, we'll give you horses, saddles, reins. We'll give you rifles, muskets, ammunition, crossbows, arrows, food, provided that you become Spanish. Well, not Spanish, but you become a new category. You become Genizaros. That means you retain your Native American ancestry, but you learn our language, you become Catholics, you adapt Spanish names like Martinez, Trujillo, Duran, Dominguez, and so forth. And you become Genizaros, and you become our allies. So whenever there's raids coming into your area, your village, or pueblo, we'll send soldiers up there, and we'll help you defeat these raiders. Anyway, in his book, he mentions that the Genizaro villages are Abiquiú, San Miguel del Vado by Las Vegas, New Mexico, San Jose, San Juan del Vado over there by Tecos, Jarales, north of Socorro, Domé. And then he also mentions that along the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, the east side villages, like the Mora Valley villages, Cimarron, Raton, Springer, Manuelitas, all those villages on that side of the mountains had Pueblo peoples that became Genizaros as allies to the Spanish.
One of the things that I'll say is that before 1598, the Pueblo Indians and the Apaches, the Comanches, were, because of the horse, they couldn't travel great distances. So it was a different, peaceful, maybe not quite as peaceful, but there wasn't so much war. Once the American Indian acquired the horse, they ran roughshod over the United States. They became no different than Attila the Hun, Genghis Khan, or the Vikings. You know, they would loot and pillage and whatever, you know. Sometimes exterminating other tribes, you know. And that was the intent on that fateful day of 1760. They were going to destroy the Taos Pueblo.
Any more questions? I'd like to see a show of hands. How many of you all? Oh, okay, go ahead, Warren.
I just had a question about how this story here relates to the story of the Sonora del Alcalde of Cornaverde and the play that they have behind them that they still in that. Is there certain connections to the story itself? Because Cornaverde, the story as the play goes on, is on a raid. I was wondering if the story wasn't this story. It was told
no.
In the surviving community.
Cuerno Verde was killed, I think, about 20 years after this massacre. Ansa came all the way from Mexico, and Ansa was a highly trained military man. And at that time, Cuerno Verde was doing a lot of damage in the northern pueblos, including Taos. He would raid a lot of the pueblos and do a lot of killing.
Generation afterwards,
yes, and Ansa, there's a book written by Wilfredo Martinez, and it's titled Cuerno Verde y Anza. And he tracked him down in what is now right around Pueblo, Colorado, and killed him, yeah, yeah.
I think that was in 1779,
right?
Around August?
It might have been. I thought it was more like 20 years after. Well, 1760, yeah, you're probably right, yeah, yeah.
1776, yeah. So it's the same generation. And I was just wondering, you know, in terms of actually seeing that play being enacted, you know, the victory over Cuerno Verde.
Cuerno Verde was feared by the Pueblos throughout the northern Pueblos because he would, he would do a lot of looting and killing.
It was good for the Pueblos, it was good for the Spanish, it was good for everyone.
Yeah.
From the point of view of those, you know, enacting the play.
You know, another person that has, you know, is hated and criticized and by a lot of people is Kit Carson. But he actually brought order to the Southwest. He actually brought peace. Well, he did his own killing, but eventually peace came after he rounded up the Apaches and relocated them. But then again, it depends on who you talk to. You know.
That young lady back there with that Summer of Love button, what's her name?
Did the Taos Pueblo Indians engage in the raids?
No. Not that I know of. Maybe you know more, Alberto. Did the Taos Pueblo engage in the raid against the Ranchos people that you know?
No, in fact, the story goes that the Comanche were here to wipe out the Taos Pueblo because they had some kind of a gathering where they danced with some scalps. And they were making fun of it, and later on they found out the scalps were Comanche scalps. So they were here for that purpose. On the way, they got sidetracked by the Villalpando.
A lot of tribes would congregate in Taos in what they call the trade fairs, and this gentleman is pretty good at that. And that's so they used to do a lot of bartering, a lot of slave trading. The Comanches, the Apaches, the Utes, the Arapahoes. And supposedly that's when this happened, is at, during one of the trade fairs, I guess the Taos Pueblos were showing off their scalps that they had taken from Comanches. And that's a story that's not confirmed, but they claim that that's why they came to exterminate the Pueblo Indians here, yeah.
I have a quick question. Only in our society and time, the way things have changed, and speaking to young people, I don't believe personally in people marking themselves. And the story I tell my daughters, because that's the way they used to mark slavery, women a long time ago, is there any theme about that that you guys come across? Well, they would either scar them, but I don't know if they would tattoo them.
That I haven't heard, not in the Southwest. Maybe it happened, but I haven't in my readings. I haven't read anything like that.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have a question about what it's like personally to be a descendant of this. I guess their family animosity towards, you know, ancestors who were harmed by another group of people?
No, because like I mentioned earlier, on my own side of the family, they took a woman captive who became my great ancestor, my great grandma. So it happened on both sides. And I grew up with my grandma in Valdez, and she used to tell me a lot of stories about her grandfather, Juan Antonio Valdez, who Valdez is named after, that they would go on plains and during the buffalo hunts. And they'd come back with Indian slaves, young girls, that they would sell to the community. And I believe my great-grandfather, when he married he never married her. They had children together. He was 38 years of age, and I think she was 16. And she was a servant at the time when his wife passed away. And she just took over the responsibility of his wife and had children from him. Those are the Herrera, yeah.
An archaeologist told me about a book concerning that called Los Pobladeros.
Yeah.
They would raid and move people around, and then they would be assimilated into that culture, and they have to get along.
There are so many good books on Taos in the Southwest in the last so many years I've read. One of them is on Tom Tobin. It's one of my favorites, who came here from Missouri. And he worked for Simeon Turley. He used to take the caravans, him and his brother Charles Ottobies, to Missouri and come back with goods over there. They traded as far as Chihuahua. And then there's the new book that came out, I think it's fairly new, on Doña Tules, you know, who aided the American troops during the annexation also. But, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I've heard, and I don't know if this is true, but I've heard several people that say the Comanches were the most fierce and wild.
I don't think the Apaches would take second place to the Comanches. They were just as bad. And, oh, yeah.
I always heard it was the Comanches.
Well, you know, the Comanches and the Utes drove the Apaches out of their original territory, which was up east of here, you know. And the Apaches, that was their home base for generations. And then the Comanche and Utes got together and drove them south and drove them out of their homeland, you know. So they were pretty fierce. And then the Comanche became very powerful and then ran the Utes back. And then the Comanche continued to get stronger and stronger. And at one time, they were the strongest and the richest tribe in the United States, with the Comanche, you know.
Yeah.
So it was quite a group, and they were extremely wealthy, very, very wealthy group. In fact, they would show up in Taos. There's stories about them coming to Taos. They'd come with a delegation, and they had interpreters for different languages, and they would be wearing French leather boots and silk shirts and conch bells and their hair, you know, done, I guess, with a do or whatever you say. And they'd come very sophisticated to these groups because of all the money they had. They could afford anything they wanted, you know, at that time.
Do you know if they, you're mentioning that they were extremely wealthy, they were probably very powerful also. Did they collect tribute from a lot of the tribes, do you know?
Well, primarily selling horses and cattle, because they would steal horses from Texas and sell it here, take horses from here, and they'd go all the way, they'd go hundreds of miles into Mexico and raid. I mean, you know, it wouldn't be anything for the Comanche to go 800 or 1,000 miles into Mexico and bring horses back. And one Comanche alone many times had 2,000 horses that he owned personally. So they were extremely wealthy for that time and era. In fact, in 1849, the big gold rush occurred. These people were coming through this area, and they were selling horses and mules and things like this. So they made a lot of money during that gold rush. It's quite interesting.
So if the Comanche raiders during this particular raid killed all the men and captured all the women and children, then did those women and children escape?
Some of them were ransomed by the Hispanic families. Some of them were redeemed. Some were recaptured. And they would do this. They would raid villages, and then they would ransom them, yeah. Some of them were, not my ancestor. Yep.
And why did they do the Comanche dance in Montrose? Is this horrible history?
Eventually, they started forming alliances with the settlers. I'm not too clear on this. Maybe Lloyd might be better at telling you this. But they started forming alliances and, you know, we'll give you protection, you protect us. And then they started intermarrying also and... am I wrong here, Alberto? Is this, or Lloyd, who is really an expert on this, is Jerry Padilla, the Spanish editor of the Taos News. Yeah.
The other expert on the Comanches and the dancers and so forth is Francisco El Comanche Gonzalez. He's the leader. He's the one that revived the Comanche dancers here in Rancho de Taos. He's the main one that would know. He's a DJ for KXMT, the Spanish radio station. And the other authority on this is Enrique de la Madrid, professor of history at UNM. And his book is here. It's called Los Comanchitos, Dr. Enrique de la Madrid. So those are the two top, and Jerry Padilla, that would know more information.
one question. You brought up an interesting point about the Comanches wealthy with horses. So the horses weren't here. There were no horses here. The Spanish brought the horses. 2,000 is a big number.
Very, very.
In 200 years, this population of horses grew to be, must have been huge.
Yeah, this was closer to.
I realized that Coronado came in about 1540, and of course, that's when they would have horses run off into the fields and then multiply. So as 1540, there were horses that were loose out in the prairies. And then the Indians, primarily the Utes, got the horses first. And then from there, then the other tribes, the Comanches, started picking up the horses. And, but again, like I say, the Comanches themselves were some of the best horse breeders, and I guess it was just a natural thing. But they developed the Appaloosa, and very quickly they started increasing the population. So by the years we're talking about here, 1760, many years have passed, many generations, so we've had a huge population of horses throughout the entire.
You're looking back at 160 years, so, yeah.
I'm just looking at our elk population, which are introduced species, in almost 100 years. Mm-hmm. So that number is in correlation to this.
Yeah. I've always heard this. Well, it's possible. I say there's claims on that because they both actually the Comanche probably had more skills in breeding, but I can say I'm not very good at that. Just put that in there,
While we're trading between us,
What would be your explanation for why the Taos Pueblo Native Americans do not appear to have been raiders?
They had mastered agriculture. They were farmers. So they weren't, what's that name? They didn't, like the Comanches would, and the other tribes would go from place to place hunting the buffalo. The Pueblo Indian had already mastered agriculture, so they didn't have to go out and look for food. They grew it, yeah. And that's probably why, most of the 8 northern Pueblos were never considered or were never put on reservations like the Apaches and the Comanches, because they were, even though they were, they defended themselves and they fought also. But, but they weren't nomadic as the other ones. Yeah, that was the word I was looking for.
I understand that the Hopi Indians have been here as long as the Anasazi. And then later on I heard that the Hopis and not the Apaches, but the Navajos were fighting for some property. You know, that the Navajos were claiming properties from the Hopis. According to what I've heard is that the Hopis have been here a long, long time, much longer, but as long as the Anasazi have been here.
Well, they're probably descendants of the Anasazis, if anything. They're probably descendants of the Anasazis. And I know that I think they settled that dispute several years ago where they set up other boundaries between them, yeah.
I'd like to add that that book called Comanche Empire, there's a section in there that describes that the Hopi were living where Abiquiu is now, all the way to Santa Fe. But because of raids with the Navajo and fights with the other tribes, they moved down toward Jemez by Los Alamos. And then later on, they left to where they live now in northern Arizona.
They're now in northern Arizona? Oh, yeah.
What were the 8 northern tribes?
Oh, boy. Start from here in Acoma and Pueblo Wingenau, that used to be San Juan, and...
Well, I would just like to add that there's a number of books in the library that have the names of all the Pueblos.
Yeah.
And in fact, okay, from Santa Fe to Taos, there's 8 northern Pueblos. But in the whole state, maybe there's 18. But when the Spanish came, Peter, about how many were there?
80.
80 Indian Pueblos when the Spanish arrived. 80. So anyway, they have books here. So thank you. Thank you very much for that question.
There are only 19 left.
In the state.
In the state.
I'd like to add here that Peter Mekanis is one of Taos's foremost historians on El Camino Real, the Old Spanish Trail, Kiowa Trail, Kit Carson Trail, and he's a very good friend of mine, and I'm very glad that he's here attending these lectures. He and I were very involved from year 2000 to 2006 concerning El Camino Real. Anyways, yes, sir.
I heard that before the Pueblo Revolt of 1680, that the Apache, the Navajo, the Comanche, and the Ute weren't in northern New Mexico. They were not in New Mexico. So where were they, Colorado, or further north, or what?
They had come down from Canada, actually, Apaches and Navajos.
Correct.
And they had come down just prior to the Spanish.
Yeah.
So they were relatively newcomers. And that's why they
after 1700, they arrived after 1700. That's what happened.
I wanted to add here that here in the library, they have about a 14-volume set of books called Handbook on North American Indians. And there's one called The Great Basin. That's the heading on the book. And the Southwest Indians and Pacific Coast Indian Tribes. But anyway, the one called The Great Basin Tribes, it has a number of writings and research that will answer your question. And
that's the reason that if the Spanish came over here barefooted, you know, with priests and this and that, you know, walking and this, how come they never encountered the Apache and the Navajo, the Ute and the Comanche when they were coming, you know, this way, being that they were that fierce, that violent? They only encountered Pueblo Indians.
Well, there were encounters and there were.
But see, at that point, the Apaches probably didn't have the horse, which they acquired afterwards. So
the thing is, you know, if the Spanish were here, you can always, you know, attack him, by foot or whatever, no? On foot. But it looks like there were no encounters with them. Yeah, just Pueblo Indians.
But that was pre-horse.
If you want to attack somebody, you can still attack him, you know, without a horse, you know, make him assault or whatever, wait for him at some place.
Well, there was nothing that they could steal. There were no horses that Apaches and Comanches could steal.
The Spaniards, when they first came to New Mexico, depended heavily on the Native Americans that were here, as far as their corn. In fact, in some cases, I think when they had the first battle with the Yakumas were tired, you know, because they were running short on their own stores of grain, you know. Had the Native Americans not been here, the Spaniards might have never stayed here. They might have gone back to Mexico. But, yeah. Yes, sir.
Well, that brings up an important, I think, interesting point that I don't know. Together, on the one hand, there seems to be this really sense of generosity among the Pueblos, and even the, you know, all tribes, to visitors, to strangers. And on the other hand, what you just said was, well, if the Cerdon fears, why weren't the Spanish eliminated with the first travels? Do you have any thoughts on that? Because I've heard both sides of that story about, you know, being very welcoming and open and assisting with food and provisions.
When the Spaniards first came to New Mexico, they were not as vulnerable as they were much more vulnerable 100 years afterwards. At that time, they were still an army, and they came with their technology, with their horses, they came with their muskets. What happened to the later Spaniards, the settlers, unlike the United States that established forts all throughout the Southwest, the Spaniards had no protection. And not only did they have no protection, but they were pretty, dispersed, yeah, is one word, but isolated. They were completely isolated from Mexico. At that time, you know, Mexico was booming with their silver mines, and to them, this was a new frontier. That's why when you hear about New Mexico, you don't hear too much about Colorado, Wyoming. New Mexico was Nuevo Mexico, Nuevo España. It encompassed the whole northern United States, was Nuevo Mexico. You know, there was no boundaries. And that was one reason that the Indians were peaceful, because the Spaniards came with their swords, their horses, and they were pretty awesome when they first came here. And then again, the Pueblo Indians were not a warlike people. They were agricultural. They were already surviving off the land. They were not nomadic like the other tribes that...
I think that the sense of surprise was really crucial as well. I mean, you see the story played out, at least among the Aztecs and the Inca. You see this warlike excursionary party with all of the accoutrements of horses and armor and things like that. And there was a certain sense of caution. And then, once things got established, the raid began. Like, even among the Pueblos, I mean, Jorge is a perfect example. I mean, the Pueblos knew how to take the Spanish side, but they, only did it once.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to try to address Warren's question. Probably the most important weapon that Cortez had when he conquered the Aztecs in the Valley of Mexico, it wasn't the horse, it wasn't gunpowder, it was smallpox. And when Coronado entered New Mexico in 1540, the reason he records, probably the reason he records the abandonment of hundreds of Pueblos, they were already abandoned, was because the smallpox pandemic had preceded him into New Mexico from Mexico, from the Valley of Mexico. And I think this is a very relevant issue if this reconstruction is correct. And there are some scholarly publications on this. If it was pandemic, is very relevant to our recent scare with the swine flu.
And religion, I think, might have played a part also. I think the Aztecs at that time were expecting a white man, right?
Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly ideology plays into all of it.
Yeah.
Probably also had the
same with Jared Diamond, Germs and Steel.
Bestseller book, Jared Diamond, Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Yeah, it's a fabulous book.
Basically explains that 95% of the indigenous population of the Western Hemisphere, 95% of what the population was in 1492 died of disease. So, 95%. Mexico probably had, in 1492, Mexico probably had 30 to 50 million people. By the 1800s, they had 1 or 2 million.
By the way, sagebrush has a lot of quinine in it.
This is Professor Dick, what's your last name? Osreicher from University of
Pittsburgh.
He's a professor of history. Paul published this book. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
This book is called Mis Primos, Los Descendientes de José Manuel Martínez y Juana María Aragón. And it is about my Martínez ancestry. When Oñate came with 129 settlers, three of my ancestors came with him, the Martinceranos, who today are called Martínezes, and sometimes Martinezes. And the Herreras and the Varelas came. Those are three of my ancestors that came. Anyway, I go back to 1598 and trace my genealogy up to that point, and a lot of things in the book. Other captives are in the book also, this Manuel de Atocha, and that's a fascinating story. But that would take another lecture, huh, Lloyd? Yeah. And I've written several articles that have been published in La Herencia. And if you want to preview my book and even preview the descendants of Maria Rosa Villalpando, I am a descendant of hers through the, as I said, she is the progenitor of the Jaques and the Valdez. The Jaques, I think, are mainly around southern Colorado, Alberto. Yeah, and of course, most of the Valdezes in Valdez are her descendants here, yeah. Yeah.
Mr. Quintan?
Gonzalez.
For the
The Godoy's part, the Godoy's own, did the Godoy's own part of the Hacienda, Padre Martinez Hacienda?
The Martinez, the original grantee was Diego de Godoy. And then also, he got killed and never established residency. And then another Spaniard by the name of Antonio Martinez purchased a land grant, or applied for the land grant that was granted by the Spanish crown. Yeah.
So look, the Godoy is a Spanish name. I thought it was, for the longest time, I thought it was French, but looks like it's Spanish, no?
It had to have been, I would think, yeah.
Peter?
This goes back a bit. My reading said that the Comanches that came in 1760s on the raid of Taos, there were 2,000 of them mounted on horseback.
Mm-hmm.
So they were a fierce lot.
Well, if you add another 1,000, it makes the story more interesting.
Yes?
I'm not sure quite how I asked this, but I think you said that alliances were made based on you taking on my religion.
I didn't say religion.
I'm wondering why it had to be religion that made the alliance, and would you do it the same? Would they have done it the same way today as them?
I don't believe that alliances were made by religion. What happened was that the alliances where you would make peace with certain settlers, and that would offer protection, and you know, it was like they would also protect you, and then they started intermarrying also. In fact, maybe you might tell me better. Avicii wasn't that granted by the Crown of Spain to Genízaros to mix breeds?
Yes, it was. It was a pueblo. But then the Spanish said, well, it's part of a land grant when the land grant system began. And so they told them, we'll come back and repopulate this pueblo, and it'll be your pueblo. But before that, it had been a Hopi pueblo. And the other day when Virgil Trujillo came here from Abiquiu, because he's a Genízaro, he said that it was called originally Moqui. And Moqui is a Hopi name, and that was what it was called first, Moqui, but then now it's called Abiquiu.
Does anyone know where the old pueblo in Ranchos used to be? Because I've heard that there was a pueblo there before the Spaniards.
I believe where Pot Creek is.
Oh, wait, yeah.
I think that's where it was, and supposedly Taos Pueblo and Picuris at one time were one. Picuris Pueblo, and then they think that maybe famine or they separated, and the Pueblos came here, and the Picuris Pueblo went the other way, yeah. Because they've done, they found, that's why it's called Pot Creek, they found many shards there, and
so there
a lot of archaeological sites there, and still going on today.
I think that there was a Pueblo at the west end of Ranchos, in the old
could be
La Plaza Pia.
Yeah, there were several pueblos, as you mentioned a while ago, 80. I believe there was another pueblo in San Cristobal, wasn't there?
Before I thank Paul.
Go ahead, sir.
Go ahead.
It was mentioned that there were some 80 tribes. Were those based on successive migrations from the north, or where did they develop as a result of far fewer tribes from the north, but then due to their isolation that they became distinct? And I would wonder as to whether genetically a lot of those 80 tribes would be very closely related.
Famine, I think, played a part in some of these pueblos not existing today. And from some of the readings that I've done in the last several years, they have found Native Americans that practiced cannibalism. This is in the last so many years that they've, you know, that there is evidence of cannibalism, and so
we. But are those 80 tribes? Are a lot of them?
You can't call it 80 tribes. There's 80 pueblos. More than 80. And what you have to think about is linguistic groups, Tiwate, Watoa, and so forth. Many of the different villages were related to one another, and they were not a result of migration. They were people who were descended probably from the original Hohokam and Anasazi.
I think Taos Pueblo is... it's a Spanish word for village, yeah, pueblo, yeah.
But it was not based on successive migrations then?
No.
I think the people here at Taos Pueblo are Tiwa, T-E-W-A, and Picuris is Tiwa, T-I-W-A, so they're...
I think it's just like in any other population. You know, you have a group living together, and then the population grows to the point that you can't support that particular population, so then they have to break off and go find new territory. And this is the way that you find that you have these new groups.
Yeah.
And it just happened.
And eventually the languages start turning a little different, yeah.
But that's just a natural process.
Vivian, thank you.
Is there a tie into Chaco Canyon? And they were a great place for trade and everything, and related to the Anastasis, I thought.
There probably is a tie-in, but we anthropologists haven't quite figured it out yet.
Well, that's...
Add to that, the Anasazi were at Mesa Verde, southern Colorado, Chaco Canyon, east of Taos, west of Taos. Then all along from Chaco all the way down to Mimbres, then from Mimbres. Then there was another trade center at Casas Grandes, Paquime, the Chichimec tribe. And then further south of that, Tenochtitlan, the Aztecas. And then further down from there to the Yucatan Peninsula, the Mayans. Let's see, somebody had a question back here.
I was going to ask about the Mesa Verde. They were Anasazis? Originally, Mesa Verde was Anasazis?
Yes.
So is Mesa Verde and Chaco Canyon the same thing?
It's in the same region.
How far from each other?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe Mark Anderson knows. I don't know.
It would probably take a whole other series of lectures. I'd really like to recommend that people who are interested in some of these subjects we've been talking to, some of them were actually overlapping to a lecture that was at Fort Bourbon last Tuesday for the Taos Archaeological Society. And the archaeologist that gave that presentation talked a lot about the specific evolution of the Tiwa community here in Taos.
Correct. Before I thank Paul H. Martinez for coming to this presentation, I would like to announce to you that our next speaker next Saturday is Rich Sanders. He'll be speaking about unknown African American heroes, explorers, traders, trappers, soldiers, and so forth. And then the following Saturday will be our last lecture, May 30th, and the presenter will be Warren Kelly. He's a teacher at Taos Charter School. And so you're all invited to come today. Thank you, Paul H. Martinez. Thank you.